I'd like to introduce the moderator for the next panel, John Hausdorfer. He's the executive director of the Center for Environment and Sustainability, and also the professor of environmental sustainability and philosophy, both at Western Colorado University. Welcome again, John, to Geography of Hope. Thanks so much for being here.
What kind of ancestor do you want to be? This is the kind of compelling question of enduring significance that can stop you in your tracks. We've heard a number of those questions already this week. Melissa last night was talking about a question that was posed to her by an elder. Are your actions worthy of the conspiracy of your ancestors? That's the kind of question that stops you in your tracks. Drew shared with us a conversation he had over coffee with Thomas Berry, in which Berry asked him to think about it's all a question of story, and that religion does not have a cosmology. And we heard from him how he's still on a journey to fully understand and enact the meaning of that new story. Winona shared with us this morning questions she's heard that stopped her in her tracks. What is it like to be free? Are we not warriors? In an essay published with the Center for Humans and Nature, she shared a statement from Wes Jackson that asked her to, as you contemplate your choices, mill about. So we all encounter statements like this in our lifetime, or questions like this in our lifetime. And I think, what kind of ancestor do you want to be is one of those questions. Steve Costa asked me to share with you how I first came to this question of what kind of ancestor do you want to be, and I'm happy to share that. About 4.5 years ago, I visited the White Earth Reservation to interview Winona LaDuc. And at the time, I was studying Aldo Leopold. That's what brought me to your last two Geography of Hopes ago in 2013, the conference you had on Leopold, an excellent event. And at the time, I was studying the link between Leopold's spiritual danger of not knowing where your food and heat come from with LaDuc's recovery of the sacred. And I thought that where Leopold is talking about that spiritual danger of being alienated from the source of your livelihood and how that reduces you to a consumer rather than a thinking and perceiving and caring being of a complex world, I thought that LaDuc's effort to recover the sacred through social justice and indigenous movements might provide an antidote to that spiritual danger. So I visited White Earth with an academic research project in mind. But I was quickly humbled. And upon arriving there, I shared with Winona, and you get a sense of Winona's bluntness and sense of humor in this story. I shared with Winona the quote from Aldo Leopold about the great spiritual danger, and she just looked at me and she said, oh, that's the spiritual danger of not giving a shit, right? And I quickly realized that I was on a different path than what I thought I was on White Earth for. Shortly after that, she introduced me to a friend of hers, a spiritual elder on the White Earth Reservation named Michael Dahl. He was on the back deck of her house, and upon meeting him, he asked me what I did. I said, well, I teach environmental ethics. And he said, well, the only ethical question that matters, I saw on my sister's Facebook page this morning, what kind of ancestor do you want to be? Michael couldn't be here with us this weekend, but I did want to kind of honor him and bring him into our presence by sharing with you the beginning of a piece I wrote in a new book that the Center for Humans and Nature put out called Wildness. This is just in honor of Michael for getting this conversation going for all of us. What kind of ancestor do you want to be? Michael Dahl's question hangs in the thick Minnesota air. I lean against the deck railing as the chill of evening tightens my skin. Two stories below, Round Lake reddens, matching the maples that are flashing their last burst of fall color. Michael, White Earth Anishinaabe and Medewin Lodge leader, offers me the intense grin I suspect he gets when he's just floored a person with an idea. This makes me like Michael Dahl. What kind of ancestor do I want to be? I repeat Michael's query slowly, quietly, talking to myself. The question implies that we are always and already ancestors. Even before our descendants are born, even if we never have children. In terms of space, nowhere is, ethically speaking, away, right? The average food item travels 3,000 miles to get to your plate. Your waste goes to this magical place called away. In an age of globalization, we grapple with how our actions impact peoples and environments on the other side of the earth. Now Michael asks me to think about ethics in terms of time. No era is away. Ethically, all times and all generations are now. So how are we to live? And that's what today's panel is about. You know, we've learned a lot about ancestors of the past. We've learned a lot about the dark stories of our past and forgiveness and how forgiveness fuels action and learning from our ancestors and moving forward. But this is about how are we always and already in this moment ancestors. And so each panelist has been generous enough to share from the heart a direct attempt at an answer, at least a new understanding in the face of this question that Michael posed to me. What kind of ancestor do you want to be? Not become, but be. So we're going to start with Melissa Nelson, who's been the all-purpose player of the conference this weekend. She's moderated two panels and shared some just really powerful insights with us throughout the weekend. As you know, she's an associate professor of American Indian Studies at San Francisco State University. She's edited a volume called Original Instructions and is also the president of the Cultural Conservancy. So let's welcome Melissa Nelson.
Bonjour, Nintinoi Maganatuk, Melissa Nindijini Kaz, Makunzi Gabuik, Idash Nindigo, Nin Piju Dodem, Nin Mikanak Wajiwing, Turtle Mountain Chippewa, Nin Dunjiba, Miyu Miigwech. I said greetings, relatives. I'm happy to be here with you today. I am an Anishinaabe woman from the Turtle Mountain Chippewa tribe through my mother's line. I'm Norwegian from my father's line, both from the deep north of North Dakota on the border of Manitoba in Canada. And I'm a member of the Lynx clan related to the Bear clan of Winona. And I'm really happy to be able to share a few words with you. And I've learned a lot from the wonderful speakers. Miigwech, thank you all for being here and sharing your wisdom, your teachings, and I look forward to some more conversation and dialogue. So, what kind of ancestor do I want to be? When I think of descendants and ancestors, I think of DNA, thanks to our dear John Trudell, the late great Lakota Sioux poet, who says the real DNA are our descendants and our ancestors. That double spiral of the past that we inherit and the future that we're leading towards. And in between that is the present moment. We're all here right now, as Ilarion reminded us. This moment is the doorway to co-creation, the threshold of creation. In our creation stories, creation didn't end on the seventh day. It's ongoing. And we're participating it right now, which requires great responsibility and obligation. As Winona talked about, we are in an epic moment. We are in an epic historic moment right now. And so what kind of ancestor do I want to be? I really look at the teachers that have informed me and the qualities and traits that they had. And it was my choice in this life not to have biological children, so I will not have those future seeds continue. But I have been very, very, a very good teacher of these seeds, the seeds that give us food. And so part of holding an ancestral legacy is also holding the seeds, the literal seeds that we inherit from our ancestors. So I've been very, very fortunate to work with a number of Native farmers and food gatherers and traditional knowledge holders who want to continue and leave good seeds for future generations so that we have food, we have sustainability, we have sovereignty, and we have nourishment, ecological nourishment, personal nourishment, physical nourishment, and most importantly, spiritual nourishment. And so I want to just point to this beautiful spiral here that, thanks to Wendy Johnson, brought the seeds that we've been growing, we were the caretakers and guardians for, thanks to the generosity of many people. These seeds come from Hopi Nation, Taos Pueblo, Tohono O'odham Nation, the Seneca Nation, the Mohawk Nations, And for us, as Rowan White, the great Mohawk seed saver, says, when you plant a seed, that's a symbol of hope. It means you know there's going to be food for the future. And so with these seeds, we tried to spread them far and wide through an abundance consciousness, not through a scarcity consciousness. And I think when I want people to look back at me as an ancestor, that it was with generosity, it was with kindness, it was with compassion, like many of my teachers have demonstrated. And it was also with fierceness. It's standing up for justice, saying no to racism, saying no to ecocide. And I think we have many great models here, especially with beloved Sister Winona as a fierce warrior and protector and standing up for what we need to do. So being an ancestor for me means being able to stand up and to be able to sit down. As the Zen people say, you know, don't just do something, sit there. And don't just sit there, do something. It's a koan, it's a conundrum of our times. We have to both sit and stand, rest and activate. And we have to be both midwives to a new consciousness, to our eighth fire and our Anishinaabe prophecy, the new generation. I'm so happy to see young people here today. I learn a lot from the young people. Yeah, you guys are the future. And from our elders. So creating contexts and safe spaces for intergenerational sharing, intertribal sharing, intercultural sharing. I want to be an ancestor who held space for conversations that are difficult, that are challenging. Spaces where we can grieve, spaces where we can tell truth, spaces for those shadow stories to come out. There's a lot of shadow stories, and there's a lot of shame behind those. How do we actually open up those dark spaces to release that shame, to release that trauma, to transform it into positive identity and action? So those are some of the qualities of being a good ancestor, and I really appreciate this opportunity to share a few words. I know you've been talked at a lot, and I'm actually very interested in some more dialogue and conversation with my co-panelists and with all of you. So I'll leave it at that for now. Chimigwich.
Thank you. And you all have met Drew Dellinger last night, a very powerful talk about cosmology, ecology, and social justice. He's the author of Love Letter to the Milky Way. So let's welcome Drew again.
All right. How y'all doing? Wow, it's just been such an amazing and powerful morning, and thanks for starting off the afternoon, and Sylvie. I sometimes think that ecology and spirituality are kind of the same thing somehow, because, and like Buddhism and like cosmology, because that to me, part of the essence is awareness of and realization of absolute interdependence and interconnectedness. And so if we think of the truth of ecology, that everything is interconnected, and we think of ecology as the science of interconnectedness, you know, that's a principle that goes far beyond how an ecosystem operates. I mean, that also goes to human history. I mean, I sometimes present at conferences where there's lots of white folks who are into interconnectedness and, you know, oneness. And they think that everything is connected. And yet somehow they don't seem to think that our current society has any connection to the Virginia slave codes of 1705. You see what I'm saying? This is all interwoven. The present moment is built on legacies of stolen labor and stolen land, genocide and slavery, right? Our privilege as, you know, however you're situated, me, a white male, mostly heterosexual, born in the United States. I mean, I've got layers upon layers of privilege, but whatever your situatedness is, our privilege, and just about all of us are privileged in some ways and oppressed in others, but every privilege that we have is connected to somebody else's oppression, if it's an unearned privilege. It has to be unearned at the cost of someone else's oppression. So in terms of what kind of ancestor I want to be, I aspire to be somebody who tried to be on the right side of history. I aspire to be somebody who tried to look at the larger dynamics of history and who reflected deeply enough on how those dynamics of history continue to manifest, re-perpetuate themselves in the future. I mean, in the present, right? We are not disconnected. You know, Faulkner said it best, perhaps. The past is not dead. It's not even past. So, I do think that we have to kind of walk a balance in this life because, you know, as far as I know, I don't know what happens after we die. I don't know about reincarnation per se. So as far as I know for sure, we get this journey on earth in this lifetime. And as traumatic and pervasive as the troubles of the world and the struggles of the world are, I think we also have a responsibility to the one life that we've been given to live with some joy, to live with some humor, to live with creativity and compassion. I mean, it would just be such a grim existence if we had to feel like we can't smile because we're in the struggle all the time. So I think we have to create. I mean, just for this, even for the struggle's sake, it ain't going to be that effective a struggle if there's not joy, compassion, connection, humor, community, right? So I try to balance that, trying to live my life in a worthy and joyful way and engage in creative expression because I think that's important for human happiness. And at the same time, have a commitment and a sense of accountability and responsibility to dynamics larger than myself. What is happening in my community? What is happening in my nation? What is happening on this planet in terms of the poverty, the violence, the brutality, the abuse, race, class, and gender, all those intersecting oppressions. So I think, it takes a lot of work to be on the right side of history. It's not as easy as we think. It's very easy to look back 30 years later and pretend like we were on the right side of history. But when you go back and you look at the polling, 2/3 of the people were against the Freedom Rides while they were happening. And the numbers are similar for African Americans. Like half the African Americans were against the Freedom Rides while they were happening. You see what I'm saying? There was a sense that this was, this kind of sense that it was all together. And now you have corporations and everybody look, it's like you'd think that, I mean, Martin Luther King could not have marched with as many people who claim to have marched with Martin Luther King. You know, the Coca-Cola Corporation puts out a full-page ad celebrating Coretta Scott King when she passes, and I think that's perfectly appropriate. But we have to remember that what did Martin Luther King say on the last night he was on this planet? Boycott Coca-Cola. He said boycott Wonder Bread. He said boycott Seal Test Milk, right? Because he was really going hard into economic injustice and how to boycott these corporations that were taking black dollars but not providing jobs for black people, right? So I think that spirituality, ecology, reality, the reality of absolute interdependence, interconnection, mutuality, and participation requires that we think about the impact of our lives and our collective lives on the future and future generations. And so, of course, the well-known teaching that we think about the effects of our actions on the next 7 generations. I mean, that is as powerful a conception of ethics as I've ever heard. Karma as a deep spiritual principle, right? Kind of lost track of my time, so let me close with a poem real quick. And I think that'd be wonderful. My 7 minutes. This is a poem called Ancestors and Angels. I write words to catch up to the ancestors. I write words to catch up to the ancestors. An angel told me the only way to walk through fire without getting burned is to become fire. Some days angels whisper in my ear as I walk down the street and I fall in love with every person I meet and I think maybe this could be a bliss like when Dante met Beatrice. Other days all I see is my collusion with illusion. Ghosts of projection masquerading as the radiant angel of love. You know, I feel like the ancestors brought us together. I feel like the ancestors brought us here and they expect great things. They expect us to say what we think and live how we feel and follow the hard paths that bring us near joy. They expect us to nurture all the children. I write poems to welcome angels and conjure ancestors. I pray to the angels of politics and love. I pray for justice's sake not to be relieved of my frustrations. I pray for justice's sake not to be relieved of my frustrations. At the same time burning sage and asking ancestors for patience, I march with the people to the border between nations where everything stops except the greed of corporations. Thoughts like comets calculating the complexity of the complicity. There's so much noise in the oceans, the whales can't hear each other. We're making them crazy, driving dolphins insane. What kind of ancestors are we? Thoughts like comets, leaving craters in the landscape of my consciousness. I pray to ancestors and angels, meet me in the garden. Meet me where spirit walks softly in the cool of the evening. Meet me in the garden under the wings of the bird of many colors. Meet me in the garden of your longing. Every breath is a pilgrimage. Every breath is a pilgrimage to you. I pray to be a conduit. An angel told me the only way to walk through fire, become fire.
Thank you for sharing that, Drew.
I need to make an announcement. We need 8 volunteers to remove their cars from the parking lot out here. We had committed the school district that we'd keep 20 spaces available for the ball games this afternoon. And there's a tirade going outside. And so I need 8 or 10 cars removed if I can get volunteers. 1, 2, 3. 4, 5.
I think you got 8.
6, 7, 8. Great, thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Thank you, Steve.
That's great.
Yeah, let's hear it for the car parkers.
Car removal. So great.
Good answer.
Like an airline, I'd like to give you some extra miles on your car, too.
Well, you already know Winona LaDuke. All that I'll add to her introduction is 2 quick things. One is that she showed me her beekeeping operation, but didn't have a bee suit available, so she put cheesecloth over her head and went in. And secondly, she told me my car smelled like horses, and I think that's high praise.
Thank you again, Annie Nindoy Maganatuk. I mean, right now I'm just working on being the cool granny. That's the one who, like, doesn't have the bee suit, but she, like, goes out there and talks to the bees, and they're all good. There's, like, this mythology that is created by grandmothers. Don't you all have myths that were created by your grandmothers? Like, the magical things that they do, and they make these things out of nothing, and all of a sudden there is enough food for all of the people, and then they go and they fix everything, right? This is what... So
magical
I'm working
realism.
On that one, right?
Yeah,
that's a magical realism of that, you know, and it's all of that. So that is like my goal. And So I work on that the best I can, and in the very present. But I am, you know, absolutely, you know, I want to be thought of as the very cool ancestor too. I want to be the one they say, yeah, she did that thing. Like, I like the idea that people in my village say, yeah, you're that one who got that sturgeon. I'm like, yep. Yep, we're the ones who did that. And then one time, one of my favorite things, which I've never been able to use for a funder, was this, like, I pulled up my pickup truck at this, like, at this store, like this kind of like country store on White Earth. And there was this kind of drunk guy sitting on the porch. He was a white guy. He was sitting there and he looks at me and he goes, you're that woman. I was like, you know, one of those awkward moments. You're like, could not be good, you know? He's like, you're that woman. I was like, yes, I am. He said, you're that woman, you get shit done. I was like, is that great or what? I was like, yeah. You know, so that's like kind of a vague as a mission, you know, as an ancestor to be referred to as the one who got shit done. But that's cool, right? You know? So that's kind of like my goal on that, because I come from a long line of people who got shit done. But I always laugh because, like, in my community, like, everybody is related to, like, this chief or this chief, and I was like, I came from the common people. Y'all know this thing, like, everybody's like so caught up in royalty, and even in the Indian community, it's like this chief. So I was like, I just come from the common Indians. Someone had to come from the common Indians. You know what I'm saying? It's like everybody's so busy being caught up with, like, related to some chief. I was like, no, we were just the ones who hauled sap, rice, tongue out. We were good. You know, the not notable by the anthropologist crowd. That was us. You know, good. You know. So I want to, you know, I think that's good. We should be all of those people. You know, we should be all of those people. We should, like, not be necessarily the ones that are like, you know, this person did this. We need to be the people that nourished and that grew things. And so, you know, I was thinking about this question, and I think that part of our lot at this moment is to straighten stuff out. I don't know how to put it. Like, I figure, like, that is my job. A lot of times it's, like, to straighten stuff out. And it's, like, intergenerational karmic stuff that's not sorted, right? And we all know it's out there. And so the question is, like, to me is, like, how am I going to do that in my little job? So I'm going to tell you a story of that, which is, I'm allowed to tell this story by Deb Echohawk, but she's a Pawnee seed keeper. And the Pawnees were, you know, first they were the Arikaras. And they lived up in the upper Missouri, the place where they are fracking now, which is the epicenter of northern agriculture, kind of like the Nile River Valley, right? That's what you got to think of. North Dakota was the Nile River Valley of northern agriculture, like, so tremendous, the agrobiodiversity. Some of you have seen that Buffalo Bird Woman's Garden. Like, that's the book that comes from that area. But these people, like, tremendous agrobiodiversity, and probably some of these seeds here are from there, you know. And so they were living up there. And then they split off, you know, which is how people just, you know, they just kind of, like, some of them just say, we're taking off, and we're moving out, right? And so they move south, these people, the Arikaras, and they move south, and they became the Pawnees, is what they did. And they moved to then what was Nebraska. And they were in Nebraska, and they were doing good. Like, everybody was going, you know, like, we were doing really good until things went bad. Y'all got that, right? Like, we're basically doing pretty good, right? We're working on all those 8,000 varieties of corn and stuff. We're busy, you know, making corn and doing cool stuff, right? Before Europeans came, we had a lot of cool stuff. And they had, like, all this tremendous agrobiodiversity, and then they started pushing settlers out there to Nebraska. And the way that Deb Echohawk described it, she said, you know, we got on pretty good with those settlers. They were, like, good people. You know, a lot of them were good people. And so she said, like, we were like AAA. That's how she said, like, if your horse's leg went lame, you went to see the Pawnees. You know, if you needed this, you go see the Pawnees. And so they developed, and the women helped birth each other's children, and they, you know, traded things, and they developed this relationship, which is, you know, part of what we are all seeking to do, is to develop, you know, righteous relationships, right? And it's from her description, it was respectful. And then the federal government came to force their removal, three separate removals at gunpoint. You know, and she said that the Nebraska farmers cried when those people left. They were sad too. And she said, we left, and then when we left, that's how they describe it. So they left, and they lost everything. You know, they lost land that their people had been from. They lost their people because a lot of them died on the way. They lost their graves. You know, so you can imagine the grief that occurs when you move or forced to move to Oklahoma. And she said, and then we lost our seeds because they had these sacred bundles that they brought with them. But those sacred bundles of corn and their fabulous beans, they had this one corn called the eagle corn. I think that Melissa knows what that looks like. It looks like it like has on each kernel there is an eagle. Is that like some cool breeding or what? It's like incredible. It's like incredibly beautiful corn. They're Pawnee eagle corn, so they lost it. And she said, and then so one day they grieved because the seeds would not take there. And so they would get dwindling, their bundles were dwindling. And then one day she said, I got this call from this woman named Ronnie O'Brien at the Archway Museum, I think it's called, in Nebraska. And she said, they asked if we could grow some, they could grow some of our varieties. And, the elders gathered and the Pawnee Culture Committee gathered and said, okay, we're going to send back some seeds. And they sent those seeds back to Nebraska and they flourished. And what she said is that the seeds remembered the land they came from. And I really liked that. And then those farmers kept growing those out. And then a few years ago, Honor the Earth funded some of the young Pawnees to go back and to work with those farmers, you know, and to live in their homeland, you know. And then they had, one day they had, I didn't get to go to, but they said they had Welcome Home Pawnee Days. And they had a couple busloads of Pawnees came in from Oklahoma, and 8,000 people came out to see them, you know. And so I tell this story because to me it is a story about how you work stuff out intergenerationally over time. Because corn is not a creation in nature itself. It is a creation of humans. You know, humans working with nature is how you get those varieties. It is a great gift that shows that we are beautiful, too, that we can do beautiful things. And that corn, you know, was this gift. And you know, they didn't work it out right away, but 150 years later, they worked some of that out, you know, and it was this form of redemption. And so I feel like that is a little bit all of our lot. I mean, that is what I want to be, as I want to be the person, you know, someone who helps things get right again, you know, so that I won't be a restless ancestor. You know, I want to be someone who, like, I don't want to come back and nag my descendants. You know, I got a couple of my ancestors that do that now. They're like, no. But, you know, so that's kind of my contribution to this. It's like we have this opportunity, each of us, to do that. And maybe it's intergenerational that it figures it out. But what is our piece and what is my piece? You know, that is what I kind of grapple with each day. So,
okay. Thank you. So we have about a half hour for conversation. I hope that conversation includes comments from you all. And then after that, Winona and John Evans are going to lead an opportunity, an exercise for you all to explore this question of what kind of ancestor do you want to be. So I want to open it up. And something Melissa brought up, you know, just the urgency of this question. And Drew, you were talking last night in a poem about your great-grandchildren keep you up at 3:23 in the morning. You know, and Winona, you were talking about we're living in a Selma moment. But when I present this question to my students, they often say that this is a question that comes from luxury, a kind of a head-in-the-clouds question, thinking about the long-term future when people are dying right now. How do we balance timely with timeless when it comes to this question? Like, yes, my students are right. There's something about this question that's kind of contemplative and stretches the imagination. But you all are saying there's an urgency. So how do we balance timely and timeless with this question?
In part, I mean, to me, like Standing Rock is an example. It's you have this opportunity right then to stand. And because you know, you may not know at the moment it's happening that it is a historic moment. But it is this moment where you take a breath and you step forward. You know, and then that is this intergenerational moment. And so I think that it is that's what I would say is that it is answered in the moment. Because you are, you know, we are accountable. Like, I am intergenerationally accountable. You know, that's how I consider it. You know, and I think a lot of us consider that. You know, and so it's at that moment, how will you act with that, you know, in that, when fate comes knocking, or whatever it is, when that comes knocking, are you going to shy away? Or are you going to stand there and look forward and take a breath, like Jean did this morning, take that breath. And then go, you know, but yeah. Like I said.
That's a really interesting question. And, you know, the question of timing and past, present, future, it really speaks to an underlying worldview of linear time. And that's a very Eurocentric kind of approach to time. And also, you can't have something urgent and long-term at the same time. I mean, that's an either-or kind of thinking. And I think that, you know, from Indigenous, we'll speak from our Ojibwe worldview, we have very different concept of time. And we're polycultural, not monocultural. And so there are times for great urgency and times for long-term thinking. And that's really breaking into a different cosmology, to use your word, a different worldview where we embrace multiple time frames simultaneously. We have a trickster character for that, Nana Bujou, where embracing contradiction is actually a very significant part of being human. And it gets us out of that either-or thinking so that the long-term elders are not wrong and the urgent youth are not wrong. They're both needed. And I love, there's many different teachings about this, and I'm thinking of one teaching from Jeanette Armstrong and the Okanagan people. It's actually the Four Societies process some people may be familiar with, but just one part of the four. The two are the salmon. They come from animal chiefs, and the salmon are fast and slippery and moving and always going upstream, downstream. They're moving, and that actually represents the youth because they're fast and flexible and move very, very well, very agile. And then the rooted ones are the elders, the deep, deep rooted ones who have a long term. They broke that bedrock. They get those nutrients. They have relationships going on with the mycorrhizal fungi and other underground beings. And so they have a very different perspective. And you need both of those. You can't have just one or the other. So I would just say embrace more of a polycultural, multidimensional way of thinking. They're both absolutely needed for our times.
I think one of the ways you do it is you build a massive movement that includes millions and millions and millions of people. And that way, you know, like how can one person, you know, let's just say there was a situation where there was like, it's either this or that, you know. If you're one person, you might not be able to do that. If you got a mass movement, you can work on the urgent emergency situations. Mm-hmm. You can work on the long-term goals. You know, Joanna Macy, I'm sure plenty of you know, talks about holding actions as being very important. We have to hold back the destruction, but at the same time that we're doing you know, shifts in consciousness and building alternative structures. So if you're one person, can you do all of that at once? Probably not. But if we build a mass-based movement that includes millions and millions of people with diverse interests, inclinations, talents, communities, and orientation. You see what I'm saying? So let's build a mass movement. I think history moves when people come together in mass-based movements. I mean, I think there's many, many different approaches. We need to work on the inside and the outside, on the spiritual and the activist. You know, I remember Joanna saying one time, you know, like, people say to me, should we do inner work or outer work? And I said, we don't have time to do anything but both. So, but to me, that's part of my vision of a mass movement, is that, you know, one person can't do, you know, hold all of the tensions and work on all of the issues, but collectively as a movement, it's could be staggering what we could do.
Just thinking about one time when you visited my campus, Winona, you shared a picture of an 800-year-old squash. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind sharing that story?
The squash story?
Yeah, do you mind?
No.
I don't want to tell it for you.
And I forgot to bring my seeds for. I didn't.
I know.
She's like, "Where's my seeds?"
Where's my seeds?
So, this is a story. I was. It was about 8-9 years ago, and this man came to me from Menominee Reservation, and he gave me these seeds, which I had heard about these seeds, and he said they're from a squash. That the story was this: is that there was an archaeological dig near Green Bay, Wisconsin, and in this dig, you know, they're digging around, which is what they do. They found a clay ball, and that clay ball, they shook it, and there was something in it, and they cracked it open, and there was these squash seeds. They were carbon dated to be 800 years old. And so this squash was passed, and they grew it at Menominee, and I saw it was like this. And then, but I, you know, I love, so it was like this like that. And so I grew them. You know, I had to wait for a little bit to grow them because my house had burned, and so I wasn't really settled, and I didn't want to do anything that great. You know what I mean? When you're still kind of like not settled yet. So I waited, and then I planted them, and so then I started to tell the story, and they grew fabulously, you know, and so then people would say, like, well, what's that squash called? What's that squash called? I'd be like, I don't know. And then I was like, well, you know, like what I always say is, like, white guys get to name stuff all the time. Like, they're busy naming. Do you ever notice that? They're, like, so busy naming everything, you know? And so I was like, right? It's so true, though, right? They got to have, like, a little. So I was like, okay, so I'm going to name this squash. So I named this squash Gete Okosumim, which means something like really cool old squash, right? Which seemed like a perfect name for it, you know, like the perfect. And so then it was funny because, you know, I had this one guy who works with our community, and he's super, like, I don't know what you call him. He's special. Zach is special. But Zach's super special. He's like, I don't think that's the right story. I don't think that's the right story. So it's like digging and digging. And, you know, there's some different stories of the origin, but he comes up with, he says it's, he said, that's not the right story, Winona. I said, well, that's the way it was told to me. And he says, I've researched it further, and it's actually a 1,000-year-old Miami squash. So I thought that was kind of funny because, like, my story wasn't good enough. So I thought, it was 1,000 years old. It wasn't 800, you know, so it's like a really cool old squash. And we refer to it as the time traveler, you know, because to me, and then if anybody who grows, like, some of these varieties, because someone gave me, I had this long note because, like, I'm like, you know, one of the mothers of the squash, I feel like, because everybody knows the story, and I had the seed, and I got it out, right? It's like I distribute it. And then one day I get this note back from someone, and they had this long history of the province of the squash, like how I gave the seed to this person, to this person, to this, you know how that is? And this person gave it to this, so it was like 5 years later. Right, and they give me back the seed, and they're so proud, and I was like, that's so cool, so go plant it, and it wasn't even the same squash. And I was like, but it was so funny, because it was actually what I would call a Mandan squash. And I was like, so then I was like, oh, I know that one, that's my other friend. You know, because it was like, when you plant something in these heritage seeds, and then you see, like, your old friend from a different crop. And so somehow they might have got them mixed up, there are two different varieties, but I had, you know, worked on both of them. And so I was like, no, that is not Gete Okosumim, that is my Mandan sister. Yeah. So I think that plants teach you a lot about intergenerational and ancestral, you know, teachings, because they are so patient, and they live, and then they come back, and they, you know, reemerge, and I just, yeah.
Yeah, and Melissa, your comment about, you know, challenging linear time and challenging that binary between short-term and long-term actually made me think of that story, because I think the tendency for a white archaeologist would be, like, hold on to those seeds, put them in a museum, they're freaking 8,000 years old, and what level of faith do you need to have in your ancestors and your own connection with the instructions on how your ancestors used the land that you still understand now as an ancestor for your descendants to then go and plant that seed is really moving. It's really moving.
But then also, yeah. I mean, like, a lot of these seeds, I mean, everything is, like, alive because you share life with it. You know, and so you can't hoard the things. You have to, it's like all of our sacred items, like our drums, they were museums, they have to be feasted. They have to be, your relationship has to be reaffirmed. And, you know, that's what, you know, our ancestors, that's what they say is, like, that they're so happy when you feast those things that came back, that your ancestors are happy, you know, and that they see those things come back out, they're happy about it. You know, and so I think about, you know, we want to ensure, you know, impart to our children that we reaffirm our spiritual practice through that, you know, we feast it and we do that and we do what our ancestors did, and that's how they will continue to reaffirm that happiness, you know.
Absolutely, and that's tied to the whole process you mentioned earlier of repatriation. So I want to be an ancestor who's remembered for returning things, you know, returning the seeds, returning the bundles, returning the sacred objects. I mean, museums and universities today are just filled with stolen property. You know, help be part of the people who return things to where they belong, because as Winona is saying, from our worldviews, they need to return home. They need to be fed. They're part of our families. They're part of our lineage. They're part of our future generations. So let's be a part of returning things that were wrongfully taken. Mm-hmm. That's a big, big part of what my teachers and ancestors have taught me.
Yeah, and it raises the question of when you're thinking about returning things and you're thinking about trust in the instructions passed down from creator to land, to ancestors, to you, to descendants, and somehow it's in a larger cycle, not a linear approach. It seems that the land measures our ancestry, or the land is an ancestor. For example, when I talked more with Michael Dahl about his question, he talked about ricing. And he talked about how, for him, you know, those rice populations are endangered. You mentioned pipelines, but there's also climate change affects the window that's needed. There's acid rain issues. It's being patented elsewhere, right? There's all these challenges. And for Michael Dahl, he said if his great-grandkids aren't rolling around in rice that looks like a moose hide on the garage floor in the morning, he hasn't been a good ancestor. And so for him, it seemed like the land measured it, and that challenged me. I started asking myself, well, what's my rice? What's my land-based, you know, cultural keystone for whether or not I've been a good ancestor? I'm a transient descendant of transient people. I'm a descendant of privilege. I don't have that indigenous connection, nor do I want to misappropriate it, right? And so that's been a challenge for me to think through. But for you all, to what extent is this ancestor question answered by the land, or will it ultimately be answered by the land?
But wasn't your answer in your essay snow?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
You know, I live at the headwaters of the West, and that snowpack is the basis of the economy, culture, ecology of where I live and everywhere all the way down to the Gulf of California. It also ties me to my grandparents who were ski bums, you know. And so there's a family connection, but also an ecological and cultural vital needs connection to what my place needs, and all of which is threatened by climate change. So I've struggled to find mine, struggled to kind of become native to place, as Wes Jackson talks about. But to what extent do you all think about the land as a measurement of our ancestry?
Well, I'm similar to you, John, I guess, in some ways, in the sense that I don't feel like I'm a super land-based person. You know, I'm from North Carolina. I live in California now. I love the land where I go. I love the cosmos and the stars and the atmosphere and the changing, ever-magnificent sky, you know, and this type of thing. But so it's not like there's one bioregion where, like, if this stand of trees isn't there in 100 years, then I fail. But, you know, the ecologically, we could think of 100 different metrics along the lines of what we were talking about in terms of atmosphere, you know, parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, inches of topsoil, you know, that are being washed downstream by industrial agriculture, you know, and this type of thing. And I think that's part of why a sense of the cosmos as our ancestor and the planet as a sense of deep time. I mean, we're still just beginning. We're at the very beginnings of understanding in terms of Western knowledge, and like the geologists 200 years ago were going like, wait, this may be older than 10,000 years, you know, and now how much have we learned in terms of Western knowledge in the last couple centuries, and we have this immense new ability to appreciate the preciousness of the planet. To understand, it's unfathomable, really, for human kind of grasping the scale of mathematics, to understand how many millions and millions and millions of years it takes to get 6 feet of topsoil like was on this continent when Europeans arrived. You know, it's how many millions, you know, every species here was coaxed lovingly into existence as part of a 13.8 billion year process. So every species, you know, Thomas Berry used to say, every species is a mode of divine presence. We're losing modes of divine presence when we extinct a species. And so I think this sense of cosmological time, geological time, deep time can give us a sense of how intricately delicate and vulnerable the planet, the biosphere of the planet is. I mean, certainly resilient, but also can be screwed up. Particularly for the short-term future. We don't know how resilient the Earth will be in millions and millions of years. But, sometimes people say, let me just finish with this thought. Sometimes people say, the Earth will be fine. The Earth will be fine. It's humans. You know, there's so many different ways we could go with that concept. But I like to remind people that the biological expression of the Earth is also the Earth. The Earth is not just the lithosphere the rocks. So the Earth is already not okay. I mean, the Earth, like I say, we don't know. In 15 million years, maybe some species will come back. But we, the corporations are and the capitalist economy is taking a chainsaw to the web of life. We are shredding what is the Earth by definition, by some definitions, right now as we speak, with 20,000 species going into extinction each year. So I think when we think about species that had to be coaxed into existence by a mysterious and creative process that we only scarcely understand over 13 billion years, and then we're going to be so reckless, short-sighted, solipsistic, and hubristic to allow the Industrial Revolution to push, you know, half of the living majesty of Earth into extinction in a couple of centuries. I mean, it's unfathomable the difference between 65 million years of the Cenozoic period and a couple centuries since the Industrial Revolution that's shredding the biosphere.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that reminder. I mean, the land is an ancestor, I mean, for us. Whether we're from that land or not, I mean, wherever we stand, we're walking on somebody's ancestors. I mean, there's no doubt. And, you know, what's at the core of our blood and what's at the core of Mother Earth? I mean, iron. The carbon of the soils, you know, that's been through this Industrial Revolution, been transformed into the sky. It's out of balance. So I think the Earth as an ancestor will definitely have the last word and is speaking very loudly to us right now. But speaking as settlers, you know, or colonists or immigrants, you know, I was relocated. Many Native people have been relocated. We know what it's like to not live on your ancestral lands by force and sometimes by choice. Hmm. And yet from our teachings, we know we're on somebody's ancestors. So I'm a, you know, Anishinaabe. I grew up in Coast Yuki territory, and I live in Coast Miwok territory, and I work in Ohlone territory, and they're still here, and they know to take care of their ancestors. And so I've become a student and an ally of them because they're still working to take care of their ancestors, like the Ohlone and the Berkeley Shell Mound that's going on right now. And if folks want more information about that, we should definitely talk about that. It really needs a lot of help right now. One of the oldest sacred sites in the Bay Area under threat right now and needs to be protected, needs everyone to be involved with it.
I have one more question, then I want to open it up to the audience. Aldo Leopold, in talking about where he felt the human species was going, compared us to the potato bug that exterminated itself and exterminated the potato, or exterminated the potato and exterminated itself. And he asks us to think about, you know, is that our future? And then he says, you know, either we're the potato bug or we're the species that's going to figure out how to, you know, inhabit a piece of earth without defiling it. And then he says, quote, as one or the other, shall we be remembered in the derisive silence of eternity? It reminds me of your fork in the road you see for us. One path is scorched, one path is green. And that's heavy, right? And that can create us almost existential anguish about how much weight is on our shoulders as ancestors. So I just want to ask you, when you hear a question like this, what kind of ancestor do you want to be? How do you deal with that weight? Do you find it to be a liberating question? Do you find it sometimes paralyzing? It's not a binary, but, you know, how do you deal with the weight of a question like that? Keep it from paralyzing you.
I just have to be honest. I mean, like, I feel like we all got it pretty good. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I mean, I'm not in Syria. You know what I'm saying? It's like, so someone is, it, you know, so yeah. I find kind of the like, is that too heavy to deal with? I'm not making fun of you, John, but I'm like, what planet are y'all on? I mean, like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, we're here. We're super privileged. Mm-hmm. We have to make decisions. We have to do the right thing. We have access to things. All, you know, we have immense amount of access. It is, you know, perhaps the lack, you know, it is our own that we have to get our act together, you know, as individuals spiritually, to have, you know, if I had the, you know, strength of some of my ancestors, you know what I'm saying? It's like, we gotta be tough, yeah, you know, to do the right thing. And so it's like, you know, we all, you know, it's your moment to shine. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I look at it. And I never feel like the weight. I mean, you know, what I know is, like, I work pretty hard, But I know that I don't work alone, and I work with a lot of people. And the challenges that I face, like compared to the hardship in my community, mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, we have agency. Mm-hmm. We all have agency. Mm-hmm. And the question is what you do with your agency. And so I don't know who it was. Maybe it was Wes Jackson who used to talk. I think the first time I heard him say it was like talking about like the things we discuss in our fossil fuels economy. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but we're all basically living like if we had a house with 100 slaves, right? Because we're like super privileged. Most people don't know where their food, you know what I'm saying? They don't produce their food, they don't produce their heat, they don't do their clothes, they don't fix their car. A lot of people actually don't know how to do anything, from what I can figure. You know, in this generation, they buy a lot of stuff, and they get people to do stuff for them, and they play on their computers, right? I mean, not to be flippant, but, you know, to be real. You know, that is a lot of our people, and we think about lofty ideas from that position of privilege. Right? So to me, you know, it is like, that's totally fossil fuels privilege. Mm-hmm. But obviously fossil fuels privilege is crushing the planet. It's crushing the planet. You know? And so, you know, it's like time to like, you know, use our powers to do great things.
And I think that's why my students see it as kind of a question that comes from luxury, you know? And so, yeah. Thoughts?
Walking on that green path is—it's not a heavy duty. I mean, it's a sacred opportunity, right? It's filled with joy, and it's filled with life, and it's filled with affirmation, and it's filled with kinship and reciprocity. So it's not really a choice in a way, because the other choice is to be asleep and to be numb. And to be self-destructive and destructive to the life around us. So it's not really a choice in a way for me. And the other part of that is, you know, it's almost flippant to say, it's kind of a cliche now, but you know, work hard, play hard. And I mean, like, our ancestors had to work so hard. Like what we do, like you're saying, we're so privileged. We have so much opportunity. We're well fed. We go to grocery stores. We flip on lights. We have it really pretty good. And yet we work really hard as we can. And yet there's a time to turn that off. And it's one of our natural laws that you have to play hard. And you enjoy and you dance and you sing and you feast. And that joy and that community gathering is just as important as working hard. And that's our own personal renewal, just as the earth has its renewal time that keeps us going.
Mm. Right, Emma Goldman said, I don't want a revolution I can't dance to.
Yes.
Drew?
I mean, I think I'm hearing from your students, you know, which is, and we would talk about sometimes in the Challenging White Supremacy workshops in San Francisco, about how the choice to choose to be an activist is in itself kind of a privilege, because if you're born into a targeted community, it's like you don't wake up going like, oh, should I be an animal rights activist or an ecological activist or, you know, or immigrants, right? You know, it's like there are issues crashing down on your community, and you engage them to the extent that you can out of urgency and emergency. So I do think that there's a certain level of privilege when you're like, what issue do I choose to work on, you know, and this sort of thing. But again, that's part of why, you know, and some people are caught in, you know, all of us are caught to some extent in just our day-to-day trying to get by and getting our kids to where they need to be and putting food on the table and this sort of thing. So of course it's a luxury to say, let me think about the next 500 years and what kind of human civilization we can create, when, you know, a lot of people are barely getting by on the day-to-day. So yeah, there is elements of privilege in this, but again, that to me, that gets to why we need a broad-based, you know, collective movement, so that those who are struggling can get by, other folks can, you know, at some points in their lives, other folks can be thinking about the next 500 years, and yet I fully believe that we need working-class philosophers and scholars, you know, and that these people are thinkers and visionaries as much as anybody else, but, you know, we're at different places at different points in our lives. Yeah.
So, Drew, do you do these challenging white privilege
Challenging White Supremacy was a workshop that was developed by Sharon Martinez and Mickey Ellinger in the 90s, and that's where I worked with Chris Crass and a bunch of amazing anti-racist.
Do you want to come to North Dakota?
I'm not. I will come to North Dakota. I'm not as skilled as an anti-racist facilitator as some of these folks I can put you in touch with, but I'll come to North Dakota and talk trash about anything, you bet.
This would be so fun, huh?
That would be a blast.
Socially awkward moment.
I would love to come. I would be thrilled to. Yes, I'm coming to North Dakota. I'm announcing now.
That'd be fun.
Okay,
but
we have.
Also, but I will say there are, I should say, since we have, a predominantly white crowd in some ways, and one of the things I try to do because I do end up talking to a lot of predominantly white crowds, whether it's conscious folks or ecological folks or spiritual folks, is that I really consider anti-racist work and anti-oppression work sacred work. And I think it's integral to, it doesn't matter, one thing Elizabeth Batita Martinez said is that the biggest obstacle to building a mass movement is racism, white racism. So it doesn't matter what your issue is, whether you're animal rights, immigrant rights, labor rights, ecology, et cetera, if we don't deal with racism and oppression, we're never gonna be able to come together and build a mass movement. You think of the women's movement, the labor movement, et cetera. We've seen these movements splintering along the lines of white racism so many times in the past, so I really do believe. And yeah, I'm happy to go anywhere, but there are skilled anti-racist and anti-oppression trainers and organizers all over the country and probably fairly close to you. And I, no matter what your organization is or what your work is, I challenge you, if you're a predominantly white organization, to think about how you can incorporate anti-oppression work in a consistent way in your organization and your school and your institution moving forward. And not just, let's get together once a semester and talk about it. No, there are experts, there are books, there are manuals, there are trainers. You don't just stand on a hill and say, I wish I knew physics. You learn. You go to the experts, you get education. So there are anti-racist, anti-oppression leaders and trainers and facilitators, and you can pay them to come to your school, your institution, your organization.
So time flies when you're talking about the next 500 years, but we have time for a question. Yes, please.
Open up. I feel so guilty.
Yes, please.
For a coastal state agency, I bought land to add to state parks, and I did wetland restoration. And I've lived in California all my life, and it's just absolutely hurt me to see what's happened in California since I was a little girl, when the population was about 8 million, and now it's 40 million. So that hurts me deeply inside of me. But I care about humans and other species. But I was making a presentation in the Grange in San Mateo, and this farmer got up to me and he said, we were trying to save the fish. My group was trying to save the fish, an endangered run of coho salmon, and also save the farmers who were getting flooded every year. So we were trying to do a project that would help both. And a farmer got up and said, all you care about is fish. You don't care about people at all. You just care about fish. And it wasn't presented that way, but that's the way he took it. He took it as if you're trying to do a project that included saving a species, another non-human species, therefore it was not the right thing to do, that it always should be about the human species. And I really thought about that a lot afterwards, and I decided that wasn't true in my case, that I cared about both. But I do lament the fact that,
Carol,
I don't know.
Carol, we need to move on. So
I know.
Do you have
how many people?
Is there a question?
There's a question.
It doesn't have to be a question. You can be the last word.
Yeah. Okay.
Elizabeth Colbert's book on the sixth extinction. We're losing animals right and left. And this is just something that we need to take on very, very seriously. They're going to go extinct in a very short period of time. So,
thank you.
All
thank
right.
you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. And we were thinking that rather than take a break, that we would let this panel leave, and that if John and Winona are okay with just moving on into the writing exercise rather than dispersing the energies.
So, you guys got your papers ready?
And you feel free. It's going to take 5 minutes to get set up. So
know,
feel free to go
cute?
Use the bathroom, like, stand up, do a little Sylvie movement if you want. But let's come back shortly.